Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Bruce D. Castle presiding. All who have business before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Thank you. Good morning, I'm Judge Castle. To my right is Judge Bartley. To my left is Judge Greenberg. We're here today in the matter of Daryl Bly, docket number 15-0502E. Would counsel of the parties please note your appearance for the record.
Good morning, Judge Castle. May it please the court, Brandon M. Selinsky with Whitcomb, Selinsky & McAuliffe on behalf of the veteran Daryl Bly.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Justin Zimmer, on behalf of the Secretary, and with me today is Kenneth Walsh.
Thank you. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Each party will have 30 minutes to present argument. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 2 minutes, please.
2 minutes, and you have it.
Thank
you. May proceed.
Thank
you. Yeah, before we go get started, we feel that the briefing on whether or not the court could grant equitable tolling is sufficient. So if you would focus whatever you have to say, and the questions will be focused on the standard that might be used by the court and whether it applies in this case.
Thank you. I'd like to start with the policy considerations of using equitable tolling with EJA. The policy considerations of EJA. The purpose of EJA was to reduce the emphasis on the cost of litigation and to encourage parties to conduct good litigation when it's necessary. When the government has wronged a person, EJA fees are there to encourage somebody to engage in that litigation.
So what is the purpose of a 30-day limit in which to file set by Congress?
Your Honor, that's a great question, because one of the considerations is whether or not the government is harmed. It's not clear that the government was harmed or is generally harmed.
So I looked at your brief, and you indicate that the test you would use as veteran would be financially harmed, as EJA fees would offset as contingent for dollar for dollar under our policies. And the second was the government was not prejudiced. So when would the government be prejudiced?
Your Honor, the consideration of prejudice is it's something that's acknowledged by the Supreme Court and by a lot of the courts that have addressed this. None of the courts have ever indicated what the prejudice is. It's not clear that the government has ever argued what their prejudice might be.
So in your briefing, you also noted that you did kind of disagree with Nelson and the requirement for extraordinary circumstances, which did not include garden variety negligence, and then you needed new due diligence. But you said it would not contribute to a consistent and reliable standard. And then you proposed this standard that I mentioned already, and now you're telling me that the second part of that standard really doesn't provide a contribute to consistent and reliable standard.
In the event the government would be prejudiced, equitable tolling should be used. And I agree that it's not clear when they would be prejudiced, and this court's held that before.
All right, as to the first standard, what about the Secretary's point that you have not been awarded a fee yet? The veteran is not hurt if you don't get an EJA. If he gets an award down below, the Secretary could offset the fact if you didn't get an EJA up here and still would not be hurt. So where would be the harm to the veteran?
I disagree, Your Honor. I don't think that the veteran can make himself whole in the event that EJA fees are not awarded. The Secretary indicated three different ways that the veteran might be made whole. One of those was 38 U.S.C. 7263. I would submit that that's not available to the veteran. In fact, the court in Fritz v. Nicholson, this court indicated that the court could not review attorney fee agreements relating to an appeal which was not currently pending before the court. It is currently pending before the court. However, it will be sent back down, has been sent back down to the BVA, and will be sent back down for further proceedings. And the claimant has not, or the veteran has not been awarded anything yet, so there's nothing to determine. So 38 U.S.C. 7263, I don't believe, is available. The next one was 38 U.S.C. 5904, and again, there's no precedent that indicates that that can be used after after this case leaves the court in order to adjust the claimant's fees to account for EJA.
So the fact that there's no precedent only means it hasn't been addressed yet.
Yes, Your Honor.
Does anything prohibit them from doing it?
Your Honor, the court would have to find that the fees are excessive and unreasonable. And I would submit that our fees are, first of all, not excessive and unreasonable. That standard usually comes up when...
If the court were to find that it was garden variety negligence that caused the failure to be timely filed in this case, couldn't the Secretary view that as giving you a full 20% when it would have been offset under the agreement that you had with the veteran to be a consideration of fairness?
If I understand your question, Your Honor, if we were to get a full 20% and we did not collect EJA fees...
And you didn't collect them because of garden variety negligence.
Right. No, I don't think that that meets the standard for excessive or unreasonable. Again, there's the definitions or the examples that come up in the case law, they don't address that.
And but wait, you just take me through this, because I'm
sure.
I'm interested. You have an attorney who represents you. The attorney is found by the court to have been negligent in not filing in time, and therefore an EJA award didn't go out. And then you get this award down below that normally would have been offset, but now isn't, only because of your attorney's negligence. And you don't think there's a fairness consideration that they could make? You think it's absolutely outside the realm?
Yes, I think there's a fairness consideration. I'll agree with that. However...
May I just interrupt?
Please.
Why should you be forced to agree or disagree with what the presiding judge says? You're here. Why do we, and we're in an equitable tolling situation. Per se, the veteran is prejudiced on a dollar-for-dollar basis, unless all these other things happen pursuant to these other statutes. Why do we need anything else except the issue of the veteran is per se prejudiced by the inability to get a dollar-for-dollar set-off against the 20% by the application of EJA? Why aren't you content with that? Or let me put it another way. Why shouldn't that be the rule the court adopts?
I agree with you, Your Honor. I think that is, in fact, I was going to kind of amend my suggestion as to the standard, Your Honor. After receiving the Secretary's brief and doing a little bit more research, I think that the most important consideration is the veteran, and we did state that in our brief. However, there's a case, Martins v. Principe. In that case, that's the primary concern, is the veteran. And the veteran will be harmed. Whether or not they would be able to thereafter recoup that money is uncertain. And I think that's
But doesn't that test eviscerate the 30-day rule? I mean, in what basis, if the consideration of some kind of negligence is not part of this test, how would you ever deny an EJA? I mean, you could come in 6 months later. What's the Secretary's prejudice? He still has his files. He still can make the argument. The veteran is always harmed, in your view, because we haven't got a resultant decision down below. So what test is there then?
I think that's true, Your Honor. The veteran is always harmed, and whether or not that 30-day rule is eviscerated, I think Martins addresses that. So in the Martins case, there are actually three considerations rather than the two that I gave. Number one, where the dismissal may financially disadvantage the veteran. Number two, error is not egregious and is easily remedied. And then number three, whether the Secretary suffers any prejudice. So,
but that was not a EJA case, was it? Wasn't that the one that was the notice of appearance, filing of the notice of appearance?
That was EJA, Your Honor.
You said Martins?
Martins, yes, Your Honor. I can give you the citation if you
like. Okay, all right, thanks.
19 Vet App 20 in 2005. Your Honor, to further respond to your question about whether it would eviscerate that rule, the question, number two, whether the error is not egregious and is easily remedied, if you wait 70 days or 80 days or 120 days instead of the 30, that's an egregious error. and the court.
So the new rule is that the Congress says 30, but the new rule is 70?
No, it was.
You felt that's where egregious came in?
Well, the rule would be certainly what egregious would be for the court, and it's on a case-by-case basis.
What do we do with the Supreme Court's Irwin case that says garden variety negligence by an attorney is not?
I think that exactly corresponds with that. That lines up exactly with Irwin. The error must not be egregious or easily remedied. And garden variety negligence would be, the court could find that that was egregious.
Well, did Scarborough against Principi have an egregious standard amount there?
I'm sorry, which case, Your Honor?
Scarborough.
Scarborough.
Justice Ginsburg's opinion. EJA, 30 days is not similar to the Henderson holding with regard to 120 days to appeal. You're familiar with Scarborough?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, what tests beyond case-by-case determination by the courts in an EJA situation did she announce or the Supreme Court announce there? Is there an egregiousness, prejudice standard there?
Your Honor, I don't recall.
There isn't. Okay. I don't believe.
No, it was jurisdictional. They said they wouldn't even rule on equitable tolling.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Can I get back to Martin's 19 vet up 20?
Yes, Your Honor.
That wasn't an untimely filing of an EJA petition. That was a secretary objected to that EJA because of the attorney hadn't filed a notice of appearance. So I'm just wondering. So you're saying that this is a comparable case, and how is this comparable whenever this is an untimely filing, as opposed to just something that apparently is ministerial, like the filing of a failure to file a notice of appearance?
Your Honor, it has to do with the same time issue. So not filed a notice of appearance, too much time went by. And the court then allowed him to, or her, I don't remember, to correct that error. And the standard that I articulated was the one that they used to find that too much time was not an issue, would not preclude the EJIP award.
Well, what's the usual standard for equitable tolling?
You know, I think that's the problem. There's not a usual standard. And there have been a number of different standards articulated, anywhere from I guess Martin's would be maybe on one end, to Irwin on the other end, Irwin and Nelson, which indicate that you can't get equitable tolling if there is, and it described in a few different ways, but garden variety negligence or excusable negligence. And as I've argued in my brief, I don't think that's a useful standard. I don't think that's something that the court can look at and determine on a case-by-case basis using that standard whether or not equitable tolling should apply.
Right. Well, we generally use a test that involves an extraordinary circumstance that caused the untimeliness, and also there's often a due diligence. The late filer must prove diligence or show diligence, or it must be shown by the record. So those are three things. In your brief, you didn't mention any extraordinary circumstances. As a matter of fact, the secretary's memo showed that the secretary's lawyer had written to you because you were questioning when should this be filed, and he actually told you, well, 30 days from the day the court issues its order. And I'm just confused about why were you late? Was it confusion or what? And also, your lateness, is there any extraordinary circumstance involved? I mean, I kind of read your memo as conceding that there isn't, because you don't mention one. But I wanted to give you the opportunity to tell us what happened, see if, in fact, we decide to use the extraordinary circumstance standard, whether your situation might fit into that.
I agree, Your Honor. There were no extraordinary circumstances. We have not alleged that. I don't think that that's true. The standard that you have identified, the extraordinary standards circumstances standard was from McCleary, and McCleary was very clear that the court was only addressing a case of extraordinary circumstances. They did not limit equitable tolling to extraordinary circumstances. The court, I think it was the Federal Circuit in Checo, picked that up and applied it to another equitable tolling case. But that original decision clearly was not intended to extend beyond extraordinary circumstances, but without limiting equitable tolling to that. In our case, we filed the brief, filed the EJIA application on day 31. That was February 5th of this year. And given the, we contend that that's still timely. We contend that that's timely because under Rule 36, Rule 36 is very clear. It says that the judgment begins the 60-day time period for appealing. Subsection B says the date of the judgment. The judgment is effective on, in Section B, the date of a court order on consent remanding the case.
Well, now I'm a little confused. You said there was no extraordinary circumstance in response to a question that included the words confusion. Are you saying you were confused despite the email from the secretary, or, because that sounds what you're trying to say now, that these rules that are out there somehow confused you?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
Not at all.
It was negligence.
No, Your Honor.
It wasn't negligence.
It was not.
You were told 30 days. The rule says 30 days, and you didn't file in 30 days.
Your Honor, we were told 30 days by opposing counsel. With all due respect, we disagree. We don't believe it is 30 days.
Okay. What does the mandate rule say? Didn't you get issued mandate in this case?
Yes.
Rule
41 addresses mandates.
What part of that is unclear?
Well, it conflicts with Rule 36, Your Honor, directly.
Well, what part of mandate is unclear that mentions the EJIA statute?
I don't believe the pardon me. I'll have to take a look at it. Your Honor, the Rule 41 indicates that mandate generally 60 days after judgment, unless mandate was issued as part of a consent order. And so, as
what's
I said,
the note say right on the bottom, the practitioner's note.
The practitioner's note is mandate is relevant to determining the expiration of time.
Keep reading. Doesn't it even cite the EJIA statute?
It does.
Right. So what part of that is confusing?
Because, again, Your Honor, it conflicts with Rule 36.
Okay.
Rule 36 also addresses mandates. It says that...
So your point is you were confused?
Not at all, Your Honor. I don't believe I'm confused. I believe
I'm
correct.
Believe your view of the rules is that you still had 60 days.
Correct.
Okay, got it.
You were just going to describe Rule 36 and explain the conflict with Rule 41, which this is something that, quite frankly, I would appreciate having had this described in your memorandum of law.
My apologies, Your
Honor.
This
was your...
It was described in our earlier brief in a response to the clerk's motion to show cause. So in an attempt not to repeat myself, that argument was exactly what we had argued in that response. Rule 36 talks about the judgment. I think I kind of went through that already. But as far as addressing the mandate, I'm going to have to look up the citation here. The court in Lister indicated that the mandate is a ministerial function which is irrelevant to the timeliness of filing an EJIA application, which again seems to conflict with Rule 41. And seems
so let me ask you, when you were doing this case or whoever was doing it for you, do you use a tickler system and did you tickler it out, 60 days from some date?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you had done this analysis and reviewed all these cases and came up with it and said, boy, this is pretty clear, it's 60 days?
I did not know, Your Honor.
Somebody in your firm did?
Presumably.
Presumably.
So there is conflict in the case law.
Just to be clear, you didn't check to see whether anyone had done that research to set the tickler and everything else?
I did not, but that's a standard part of our practice.
To particular, as Judge Castle is using it, I take it, is a objective system of compliance with time requirements of either rules or statutes. Do you understand that?
I do, Your Honor.
In other words, that you have a process within your firm, whether, can you describe it? Is it electronic?
Yes.
Does it pop up on every case for every lawyer? So many days for a statute of limitations or rule compliance and so forth.
Correct.
And that's your standard operating procedure in your firm.
Correct.
And you do that as part of your broad general practice as well as that related to veterans.
Correct.
Thank you.
Can I just return to something that your earlier response to me, which is that you had argued a conflict between Rule 41 and Rule 36 in your, was it in your response to the show cause order?
Correct.
Yeah, that is only one paragraph long, and it only mentions Rule 36. It doesn't mention any conflict or discuss or quote 41.
No, it does not, Your Honor. And I'm sorry for the confusion. I didn't mean to say that I addressed Rule 41. I did address, I made the argument that Rule 6, applying that, would show that we still had enough time. If I may continue and take a step back to, I've been explaining before the Secretary's three possibilities for the claimant to recoup money. I've only gotten through two of them. The third one was a malpractice lawsuit. I addressed that. We're not required to file for EJO, either by statute or by contract. There's no indication that that not being able to collect EJO fees would be malpractice. And again, even if there were, there would be considerable risk to the veteran. The veteran would have to prove a malpractice case, which is difficult to begin with. So I don't believe that that is a reasonable method to rely upon.
Well, why would we want to encourage malpractice litigation in these circumstances?
I don't think we do, Your Honor. It conflicts with the purpose of this court and with the idea behind EJA, as I've already articulated.
But there might be an encouragement for attorneys to file within the time prescribed by statute if the Secretary were to consider inexcusable neglect when he reviewed the 20% award that was being given. Wouldn't that encourage attorneys to focus more on what the rules say?
You probably would, Your
Honor. I want to go back to Martin's. I don't see, and again, I'm looking at it quickly here, but I don't see equitable tolling mentioned in there. Isn't equitable tolling generally referred to with statutes set up by Congress as opposed to rules of a court? And aren't the rules of the court much more liberally interpreted? I mean, that's been my understanding, but if you have a different experience, I'm open to hearing it. And while you've given an answer to that, my review of the case law has been equitable tolling is extraordinary circumstance, does involve the due diligence, and that the common variety negligence is not an extraordinary circumstance. Do you have anything contrary to that? Inequitable tolling.
Sir, Your Honor, one moment.
Certainly.
Let it parts to your question.
Well, do you see anything in the Federal Circuit case law or our case law dealing with equitable tolling of a statute that does not use the extraordinary circumstance due diligence test where garden variety negligence is not considered an extraordinary circumstance?
I do, Your Honor. One case from this court is Morrow v. McDonald.
Morrow?
Morrow, M-O-R-R-O. However, that's a case in which the court had wanted to bring in the attorney, I think, for exactly this issue. The attorney withdrew, and the court approved that withdrawal. Judge Greenberg had written, was identified as a consenting opinion. And
concurring.
Okay, it might have been concurring. I had consenting. Indicating that, again, reciting what the purpose of this court is, that it's a veteran-friendly, lawyer-friendly statute that we're working with.
So that would be persuasive. Do you have any precedential case law?
I do not, Your Honor.
Well, if I may, doesn't the Federal Circuit in Checo invite this court to expand the reasons for granting equitable tolling beyond those that have been mentioned by my colleagues here? And isn't this a case where that concept should be considered?
The court in Checo agreed that having a single standard is...
You might want to look at Checo. The court in Checo specifically talked about extraordinary circumstances.
Yes,
what it talked about is that no specific event was required for the extraordinary circumstance. For example, some of the people had read case law to say a mental disability or a physical disability or a hurricane. And those were the limited criteria. Federal Circuit made it clear that those are not the limited criteria. It's an extraordinary circumstance. And then this court had found that homelessness had been an extraordinary circumstance. So still, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe they diverted from. In fact, I think they established that extraordinary circumstance was one of the criteria for equitable tolling of the statute.
You're correct. That was the first criteria. Due diligence and causation were the other two. That court relied on McCreary. I mentioned that before. And McCreary, the McCreary case was only intended to address extraordinary circumstances. So the court in Checo did identify that, used that same standard.
Well, would you consider the inability to offset the 20%? With the EJA award to be an extraordinary circumstance contemplated by A, the statute, and B, Checo?
I think that is another way to look at extraordinary circumstance, Your Honor. The way I've understood the court has been looking at it is whether the veteran, him or herself, has experienced an extraordinary circumstance or whether the attorney has experienced.
Exactly, but you came all the way from Denver to argue this case, and you want to come away with something extra, don't you?
I would like to do right by my client.
That's right. Isn't that enough, in all seriousness? You'd like to do right by your client, the veteran, who, if this set of circumstances isn't considered extraordinary, specifically that you cannot apply for an EJA application, the veteran will have to pay the full 20% unless all this other activity occurs. So
no,
isn't that alone an extraordinary circumstance?
I won't disagree with you, Your Honor. I don't have a case that would identify that as an extraordinary circumstance.
I don't think you'll find it.
Well, even if we were to consider it an extraordinary circumstance, it doesn't appear to meet the requirement, which we haven't decided we're adopting yet, but the general requirement that the extraordinary circumstance cause the untimeliness or, you know, at least contribute to it.
Sorry, before you answer, Judge Bartley, I was speaking of an extraordinary circumstance, meaning the fact that whatever happened by the hand of the attorney results in something negative to the veteran. That's the extraordinary circumstance. So, but go ahead and answer Judge Bartley.
Thank you. I see that I'm a little bit short on time, but I'll continue if that's okay, Your Honor.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right, add 1 minute.
Thank you. Your Honor, I think your question was, even if this could be considered an extraordinary circumstance.
The financial harm to
yes.
the veteran,
Thank
eventual
you.
Financial harm.
There's no causal link to the delay in filing the application. Is that correct?
Oh, is there? Yeah.
Okay. I can't articulate one. This is admittedly after the fact that I have to come here and argue, or that I get to come here and argue. I don't think that there's a causal connection between my being here now and the time that we filed it. However, we're here at considerable expense in order to argue the case. So I don't have anything further right now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Zimmer, you have 30 minutes. You do not need to take it all unless we are continuing to question you.
I understand, Your Honor.
Or you feel a need to do so.
Your Honor, as the Secretary set forth in our supplemental memorandum of law, it's our position that the Court should dismiss this EJ application as being untimely and find that equitable tolling is not for application. It's our position that the Court should so conclude for three reasons. The first is, I think as has been touched on today, appellant has not averred or demonstrated why equitable tolling should be applied in this instance.
What about his reading of the rules? Not to be confusion, but presented as an absolute fair reading of the rules, that he still has 60 days. Isn't that his position?
I think his position is that there was some ambiguity or confusion between...
I asked him if there was confusion. He said, no, absolutely, we read the rules, and we believe we have the 60 days.
Well, it's entirely unclear to me under that theory why they filed on day 31 then versus day 60. I think that would be more of a compelling argument if they waited 60 days, they didn't. And on that point, Your Honor, even if we were to assume, and I'm not assuming or conceding this, there was some ambiguity or confusion between the rules, we have the Court's case in Bowers that it is directly on point. It says where parties agree to JMR, there's no appeal period, there's no appeal rights. I mean, Bowers is applying the rules in a factual setting that's directly analogous to this case here. And I would say, let's say we didn't, if counsel didn't have an opportunity to look at the rules, okay, fine. Go look at the Court's case law, you would have seen Bowers, and that deck directly controls.
So I recall your brief, you believe that the standard is for equitable tolling would be an extraordinary circumstance. You kind of separately said mental or physical, which would be an extraordinary circumstance in my view, but and then some type of due diligence. So the general, as my colleague expressed, the general equitable tolling dealing with the statute is the rule that you believe the Court should adopt. If we adopt one.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think the overlay for that framework is the idea that the Court can look at equitable tolling on a case-by-case basis.
Tell me about your proposal, the three proposals. Your counsel basically said that this Court really shouldn't step into, and I think you also said we shouldn't step into the fee agreement that he has up here because there's not been an award down below. Your opposing counsel talked in terms of malpractice, and certainly nobody wants to have to rely on that. So tell me about the second one, the one where the Secretary has authority. Your opposing counsel seemed to say that it was a fairness issue, but you didn't have the authority to do it. Tell me a little more why you think you have the authority to do it.
Well, absolutely. Well, under 38 U.S.C. 5904, the Secretary, on his own motion, can review a fee agreement where we have a direct payment system where, in this case, a 20% fee going to the balance council would come from the Secretary. The Secretary could review that agreement and find it unreasonable or excessive based on the fact that, in this case, an EJL application was not timely filed, and that therefore there would be no offset of that 20%, and the Secretary could find that, again, unreasonable or excessive. If I could step back to the first option under 38 U.S.C. 7263, the Secretary would suggest that's something that the Court could do here. The Court could say that on its own motion could review the fee agreement, which has already been filed in this case, and find it going prospectively, saying in the event that appellant is awarded benefits on remand to the Board before the Secretary, in the event that happens, and to the extent that he's awarded the 20%, it would be offset by the amount of...
Does this agreement talk about an offset, the one you filed with the Court?
It does, Your Honor. It says that the council will be able to file for EJL fees, and in the event if these are awarded, it would be offset on a dollar for all, it doesn't say dollar for dollar basis, but it would be offset by the EJIA amount.
Well, are you suggesting that we strike certain provisions from the agreement or find them unconscionable under the situation or words along those lines, or are you suggesting we actually write something into the agreement?
Your Honor, quite honestly, I hadn't contemplated that. This has not been done before, in my understanding. This is obviously a case of first impression as regard to the issue of equitable tolling.
And the 5904 avenue that you talked about earlier, has the Secretary ever reviewed in a case where EJIA was untimely filed up at the court? Has it reviewed it down below when the 20% past due is due and found unreasonableness because of the late EJIA filing?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. That's something we did contemplate in preparation for this case.
So there's a first for everything, you're saying?
That's my understanding, Your Honor, yes.
Any further questions? Do you have anything significant you would like to present to the court? Sorry, we have a question over here.
What's the harm to the Secretary in paying this?
Thank you, Your Honor. I was just going to get to that. You know, obviously, it's not a monetary issue, and I've got to concede that outright and be honest. But, you know, we do have an interest, as with the court, in the idea of uniform, consistent, reliable standards for administration of justice. You know, we do have a statute. We have a court rule that says each application needs to be filed within 30 days. That's our interest, and the interest is also, you know, this is one of many cases that the Secretary handles. And as Chief Judge Castle alluded to, you know,
let me just correct. I'm no longer the chief.
Yes, Your Honor. To have situations where appellant's counsel could file an EJIA 70, 82, you know, 120 days later, it really would put a wrench in the wheel of the of how we process and deal with our cases, and how the court does also, Your Honor.
But just take the 70 or 80, 100, 500 days later. The guy was in a coma. He was in jail.
Sure.
Couldn't help it. Shouldn't we consider all these factors in deciding what's equitable?
Your Honor,
I mean, surely you're not arguing that in the context of equitable, the word equity appears as part of the concept equitable,
yes, Your Honor,
that we have some sort of standard rule. It's got to be 31 days. It's got to be 59 days.
I'm not suggesting a temporal period.
Yeah, but you seem to suggest when I ask what's the prejudice or what's the harm to the Secretary, your response, as I understood it, was you wanted uniformity or predictability as to the application of certain concepts.
Sure, that's the aspirational goal, is to have these applications filed within 30 days. But again, equity addresses the situation you're talking about. If
someone's
in a coma.
And equity has to be applied by us, right?
Absolutely.
All right. And in applying equity, one of the things I think we're interested in is the position of the Secretary in terms of how have you been harmed or prejudiced, or how has the government been prejudiced by this late application?
I will concede to you it's not a monetary issue.
Will you also concede that if the EJIA application on the merits is dealt with, it will result, pursuant to either to this agreement or to general principles of what is a reasonable fee, there will be at least a dollar for dollar set off against this 20% agreement with this lawyer.
That's correct.
Therefore a benefit, an actual dollar for dollar benefit to the veteran.
But if I may?
Sure.
As was discussed earlier, we do not have a determination that there is any benefit to the veteran, and this could be a reward to the attorney alone for his representation, even though he did not meet the 30-day statutory requirement.
That's exactly right. We don't know what's going to happen in the future, and I think the concern here today was what could happen in the future that could harm the veteran, but we don't know. One option is he's awarded benefits and there's no offset, and the veteran gets less money than he otherwise would have got if his attorney filed the application. The other avenue is The veteran does not get awarded benefits on remand, and all we're dealing with today is whether or not counsel for appellant for the veteran is going to get paid for his time representing the veteran before the court today. So I guess there's a lot of uncertainty of what is going to happen in the future. But I guess if we step back for a minute to really the issue at hand is why this EJ application was not timely filed. And I haven't heard a compelling reason that would support equitable tolling in this case. And I'm not saying it shouldn't apply. I'm just saying this case, I haven't heard it. And the idea that the rules were ambiguous again, like I said, that's undermined by the Bowers case. It just doesn't fit the facts of this case. I'm not saying that it won't down the line. Just for the specifics of this case, that's why I'm urging the court to dismiss the EJ application as being untimely, Your Honors.
Anything further? Do you have anything further?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And Mr. Is it Woodcock? Slinsky. I'm sorry. Mr. Slinsky, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you. Your Honor, I understand the line of questioning about what happened. Why was this case filed 31 days late? Because it obviously looks like we dropped the ball and we waited one day too many. That is not the case. I don't think that should really affect the outcome of this case. I understand the interest in it. Secretary's counsel indicated it would be more compelling if we had filed it 60 days, because that would indicate that our mindset was that we had 60 days and that we knew that in advance. Again, I don't think that affects our argument or it should affect the outcome.
Well, let me understand. You were not involved in the filing of this. You were not involved in the tickler system, and you did not specifically check into it. So you have no information to proffer with regard to it.
I don't, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'm not saying that I was not involved in it. I wrote it. I wrote it when I was told to write it.
But you weren't involved in the timing of it?
No.
Right.
I was not.
So we're looking at a 31-day, one-day late filing, a tickler system, your system, that said 60 days. And we don't really know anything else.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
I don't have anything for you.
Anybody else? Thank you very much. Case will be submitted. We'll come down and greet counsel.
All rise.